This meeting of the Queens Municipal Council, Region of Queens, is called to order for Tuesday, March 28th. Under 1.0, we've called the meeting to order. Under 2.0, changes approval to agenda. I have one addition to the agenda today. Under 16.3, we will add property matter, MGA 22(2)(a). Any other changes or amendments to the agenda today? Hearing none, a motion to approve the amended agenda is in order. Move Councilor Freilich, second Councilor Muse. Ready for the question?
Question.
All those in favor? Thank you, it is unanimous. Under presentations 3.0, we have a presentation this morning under 3.1, West 4 Forest Management. Marcus Swicker and others, I would ask if you would like to come forward.
Yeah. For my support.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for having me, Mr. Mayor. I know him personally because he's part of our advisory committee for Western Crown Land Services, so that's who I contacted to sort of get the time today. You probably heard a little bit and read a little bit about Western Crown Land management in Nova Scotia here over the last year, and especially in the last few months, letters to the editor, the Chronicle Herald, lots of different stuff. And thank you for the opportunity to sort of come in and tell our story and how we're at where we're at today. So who is West 4? Right today it's a separate company and it's owned by 13 shareholders individually. And the reason there's 13 shareholders, there originally was going to be a few more, but they're made up of mills that historically got fiber off the former either low water land base or the Western Crown land. Okay, so each one of these mills is an owner of the company and has a allocation or a fiber allotment for the individual product that they use in their mill. All right. So what the second question everybody asked me, so what is Western Provincial Crown? So previously in total it's 2.1 million acres of land, forested land, all right? About a third of that was the former Bowater Mersey lands, all right, that were purchased in 2012. And it's made up of a whole bunch of different, I call them buckets, or land managers. So included in that, there's 300 or 788,000 acres of parks and protected, which represents just shy of 40% of the total Crown land base in Western Nova Scotia. There's the Medway Community Forest Co-op, which some of you are aware, they're currently managing a piece of land. Majority of the land base is in Annapolis County. There's the Mi'kmaq Forestry Initiative in Bear River, which is 19,000 acres. There's the Mi'kmaq Forestry Initiative in St. Croix, which is in the St. Margaret's Bay portion of the district, just outside of Windsor. Okay, and I'll show that on a map here in a second where that's located. And then there's West 4, is the group that I work for. And we represent or manage about just shy of 60% of the land. And we make up about 505,000 hectares of the entire western land base, is the area we manage. All right, so where do we manage? So it's the land base is divided up into five different districts, and they're sort of named after the former Bowater districts. So in St. Margaret's Bay, or the area just outside of Halifax, is about 12% of the land base. Queens and Shelburne East, which is the area that is predominantly Queens County, makes up almost a third of the entire land we manage. Shelburne West, Yarmouth and Digby, which is the sort of, once you get past Shelburne all the way around to Digby County, is another, is a quarter of the land base. And then Medway, if you're familiar with the former Bowater lands, that's all the lands that they had previously owned that's located in Annapolis County. And that's the lands that we work under today under an FSC management plan. And as well, there's a piece of land in Kings County called, they call it South Mountain, that was sort of old Crown, it wasn't former Bowater lands, and that makes about a fifth of it. So here's a map of the Western Crown lands. It's not all West Forest. So the orange you see on the map, that's as of January 1st, 2016, that's the actual parks and designated parks and protected area in Western Nova Scotia. All right, so that's what makes up the land base. The green, the lime green that stands out, that's the lands West Forest manages. Part of it was former Bowater and as well as Old Crown. The bright purple, that's the Medway Community Forest. And then the two dark brown areas, the one you see just outside of Bear River and the one just outside of Windsor, those are the two Mi'kmaq forestry initiatives. So the Crown set those aside and they're managed both economically and on the ground by the First Nations of Nova Scotia. And the last piece, you see the pink, that is the former Bowater Mersey Medway District. And the reason we have that separate is because it operates under a different management plan. Formerly it was certified under FSC, now SFI only. And it has different operating conditions in that piece of area. So what do we do? Right today, we're working on long-term management plans and short-term operating plans on Crown land. We do harvesting, silviculture, road construction. We ensure compliance with Crown operating procedures, regulation, and third-party certification. So right today, about a third of the land base is third-party certified through the Sustainable Forestry Initiative. That certification carried over from Bowater. And one of the conditions of our FOOL, or our long-term agreement once it's signed, is that we have a one-year window in order to get the rest of the land base third-party certified, most likely through SFI. And then the last one is, as you see, there's 13 different mills on the list. We manage and deliveries and scheduling to meet shareholder allocations. So one of the things we work on is making sure that each one of those mills gets the fiber they're allocated off the land base. So in a provincial context, of the total provincial harvest off the Western Crown lands in 2014 and 2015, again, this is before West Forest was formed, about 7% of the total provincial harvest come off these lands through short-term timber license agreements that each one of these mills previously had with the Crown on those lands. And if you look at the total provincial forested area, 12% of it in Nova Scotia today is managed or operated on by West Forest. And if you look at last year, 22% of all the mills fiber supply came from Crown land or from the West Forest allocations. So that's how much of a significant portion the mills that those guys represent or that those guys operate on, that's how much of their wood came from that land. So I put this graph in here because it sort of shows you the change in land ownership or fiber supply over time. If you date back all the way to 2010, if you look at the seven Western counties, almost 40% of the fiber came from industrial freehold, which is predominantly the former Bowater lands. And if you look at the red line, you can see the drop that it's taken almost near nil up until 2015. So with that change in both land ownership and fiber supply, two things happened. One, the private land as a percentage of the cut went up, all right, to the point that in 2015, it was almost 80% of the total wood harvested in Western Nova Scotia. And the Crown, after the purchase of the Bowater lands in 2012, you can see that's up slightly on the rise to right around 20%. Okay, so the private landowner, the private wood supply in Western Nova Scotia really backfilled the gap in of wood that previously came for those mills off the off of those lands. At the same time, though, don't be mistaken, the total industry contraction over that same time frame was 40% in Nova Scotia. So the total amount of wood harvested over that 5-year period dropped by 41%. And you guys are you're seeing mills shut down right in your town, right in your community. So that had a big impact in a lot of communities in Nova Scotia, none as much as it did here. So yes, the harvest level went down, but a lot of the if you look at the private wood supply that fed these mills, they really stepped in over the short term and fed a lot of the needs of the province. So here's a map of Queens County, and I got photographs, but I highlighted sort of the Crown land. So if you're looking at Queens County as a total, you see the orange hash marks, that's the protected area. So since the Bowater, former Bowater Mersey lands, there's been a lot of area added in the protected area in Queens County, and that's the orange hash marks. If you look at the yellow, that's actually Crown land, all right? So that's the outside, excluded from the parks and protected. And at the upper end, you see the pink in the top corner, that's a piece of Crown land that was originally designated for the Medway Community Forest. Today, we don't operate it on it, but it'll roll into our license agreement. But the reason it's shown pink there today is originally that was scheduled to be part of the Medway Community Forest Co-op.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Which parts are gated?
So today, there's two gates located on the land base that DNR has gated. It's around Lake Rosignol. All right, so at the top end, if you we come in here, probably about a third of the way across the map here, there'd be a gate located there, all right, which basically cuts off this area from would be behind the gate. And then at the top end, there's a gate going across the Mercer River, it's hard to see in the map here, but right in here somewhere, which would again would deny access around the back side of that to the general public.
And for what reason?
I can't answer that. I don't maintain or control gated access, and I have to abide by the same rules as anybody else who has access to that those lands. So we want to do work in there. We have to get permits, apply through DNR, all the same rules and regulations of everybody else that operates in that that area. But today, those gates are maintained and monitored and used between Department of Environment, because there's a significant area of protected area in there. They do most of the enforcement, and then DNR is who you go to for permitting for access. All right. In terms of total acres, I can't tell you how much is actually behind the gate, but it would probably be about a third of the area in Queens County, approximately. So harvest levels by tenure, and this sort of tells the same story. As you hear in the media and in the news that Crown land's being over-harvested compared to private, or it's not being harvested sustainably. So I just put up in terms of both the provincial and a Queens County context. Provincially, Crown land makes up 38% of the total part of the forested province in Nova Scotia. All right? And it's harvested at a 0.44 cubic meters per hectare per year. If you go all the way down, if you look at the industrial freehold, which would be the land that the companies own, they harvest that land at almost four times the rate because of the amount of silviculture investment they put in that land. And that would be sort of representative of what the Bowater-Mersey harvest volumes would have been in terms of their annual harvest rates. The next line down is what private land is harvested at in the province at 1.11. So that if you look at it in terms of relationship to the other landowner tenures, the private land is harvested at three times the rate, and industrial freeholds are actually harvested at four times the rate across the province. And if you look at Queens County, it represents 56% of the total area, and it's harvested at about 0.48 cubic meters per hectare, so not far off the provincial level. All right, so that's over the last 6 years of since 2010. And if you look at private Queens County, it represents about 0.78 cubic meters, so about 60% of the same harvest level of private. And overall, we actually represent about 56% of the total area, forested area, in Queens County. So this is another, I show this over time. You look, the red line is more in the Queens County context, not the provincial. But up until the Bowater Resolute lands were sold, over 80% of the wood harvested in Queens County come off those lands. All right, that's how much of the total harvest in this province, or in this county, come off those lands. And if you look at it, peaked in 2013, it was almost 100% replaced by private. All right, so if you look to 2013, now that's from the short-term allocations, the management agreements come in place on Crown. I suspect that number will change, but it'll probably be in that 60-40 range on a go-forward. All right, but just you look at the drastic drop-off of the mill's fiber supply, including some of the owners that are in here today. They used to get a lot of their fiber from the Queensland, Mersey lands. And again, there's the actual cuts on the industrial and Crown land in Queens. So it peaked again in 2011 all the way up to 263,000 tons, and it dropped all the way to 2013 to 18,000. That's a significant change in how the mills secured their fiber in a short period of time overnight. Now again, you can see up to 2015, it was up to 60,000. But the sustainable level for Queens County is right around 200,000 tons a year, which is right where Bowater was harvesting their annual volume over time, right around 200,000 tons. So we're well below that number, and we have been for the last 4 years. So year one, the company was formed late 2015, started 2016. So the first thing that happened was we transitioned through January, February, from short-term license allocations between each mill. So like I said before, each mill had an agreement directly with the Crown for a certain volume of wood. And today that license, or that timber license, is held by Westport. We started operations planning for harvesting and roads. 100% of what we do today, we do 100% of the road harvesting planning. We negotiated a 10-year, we're in the process of negotiating a 10-year FULA. And the Crown's terms, that's considered a fiber utilization license agreement. We fulfilled the majority of owner mill allocations. We were over 80% of the actual allocations. They were received from the mills. We implemented a new Crown land monitoring process. We trained a new workforce. We actually have 7 field people out there today doing the on-the-ground planning and work. And just in terms of, you hear the thing, all we do is clear cuts, and I got the stat up here, and I also got some pictures to show you guys, some work that was actually done in Queens County. Last year, 52% of it were clear cut treatments. So if you look across the Western Crown land, 52% of the treatments we did were clear cutting, and we operated on about 2,600 hectares. All right, so about 0.4% of the land we managed, we operated on last year. So year two, so we're already almost at the end of quarter one for our year two. So we've already submitted our next 2-year operating plan. So where we'll be working over the next 2 years. We'll be finalizing a full or a 10-year agreement. We're actually, this year will be the first year we actually manage the silviculture program on Crown land in Western Nova Scotia. So that's tree planting, thinning, and PCT. We'll be finalizing the protocol documents for planning and operations. And we'll begin the transition to third-party certification. I had a gentleman in the back previous to the meeting ask me if we were standing forest initiative. Today, again, it's only a third of the area. One of our requirements is that the whole land base will be third-party certified. And then to go along with that, we'll begin the long-term management plan. So that's a 100-year management plan for the area. Consultation with First Nations. So before any of that stuff's in place, we do a process where we consult the First Nations of Nova Scotia. And then I put on the bottom, we're managing public perception and information, and that's one of the reasons why I'm here today. So just, this is a harvest block that actually made the news media last summer. Some of you guys might have been aware. This is a block that we planned right next to Kedgy Park. So if you look at the top end, you see the hard orange there. That's Kedgy Gouja. All right, so this block still wasn't approved. We still haven't got the go-ahead to do it, but this is what we would have submitted to a Crown. This is a typical harvest block. So in there you see the two pink circles. So we identified, the logging planters on the ground identified 2 individual goshawk nests. So that's a bird of prey here in Western Nova Scotia. Each one got a 28-acre no-touch buffer around it, which is a significant amount of area. It's located in the moose management area, in some parts of Nova Scotia, to try and bring back the endangered mainland moose. There are certain conditions we have to abide by. And if you look at the red hash, we have to offset for every year we harvest, we have to offset 30% of the same amount of area, the same forest type in perpetuity for moose habitat. It borders on the protected area. We have to do on-the-ground FEC and PTA treatments that we dig soil pits, we do vegetation type, and we do tree species composition that tells us what treatment we can do on the ground. In this instance, you see the green, that's actually going to be scheduled for a shelterwood harvest, and the brown area on the bottom is a selection harvest. So in both cases, we would only remove about 30% of the trees from the site. So these are actually stands that were operated in Queens County, both of them in the Rossignol district. The one on the left-hand side was a single tree selection that was done by a local contractor, and that's him and his crew there because they're quite proud of their job, so I took their picture one day. And the other one was a pine sea tree. That's a clear cut, by the way, because you removed over 50% of the volume on the stand. So if you're looking at the harvest map viewer that's available to the public, if you clicked on that block, that would actually be identified as a clear cut. But that was a pine sea tree harvest we did in Rossignol, almost down by the lake. And then, again, there's some more harvests we did. One was a softwood patch cut because we needed to get sunlight down to regeneration. And the other one was a commercial thinning we did in a 4-year-old PCT stand. And we don't operate solely in softwood, although a lot of the industry around here relies on that product for their mill. On the left-hand side, you see that was a sugar maple stand. That we did a single tree selection in with the hope to grow some future saw logs. And on the right was that was a beautiful stand of wood. We actually removed 40% of the volume from the site and we were still left with over 40 cords per acre left standing. And again, that was another stand we did in the Herring Cove area of Queens County. And those, here's some more, just some more shelterwood harvests we did in Queens County. We do them a combination. I got managed stand. One was a plantation on the left. We entered that stand at the 30 years old, and then the one on the right-hand side was actually a mixed wood stand that you can see the forwarder. No one would realize, but that machine weighs 25 tons, and you can barely see it going through the woods. But that's actually a hardwood, softwood stand that we targeted removing all the older trees or the balsam fir that was dying out and left the yellow birch, sugar maple, and hemlock and spruce in that stand. So I get lots of questions about sustainability. How are you sustainable? So right today we work on a 100-year management plan. So our harvest levels are set and projected out into the future, 100 years, with non-declining volumes, which means the growing stock in the land base can never go below the lowest point anywhere in that 100-year time horizon. And we do that, we also ensure that all the landscape, so this is modeled spatially across the landscape, the forest and all the habitat targets are met. We also do a 25-year tactical plan and a 5-year operating plan. So we normally work in a 5-year operating plan in terms of where on the ground we're going to do what we do. And then at the 1-year level, we identify roads, harvesting, silviculture, with pre-treatment assessments, approved by DNR, their integrated resource management team. As well, it's reviewed by the Mi'kmaq of Nova Scotia, the Assembly of Chiefs. They typically review our they take 6 to 8 months to review our operating plans. Then as well, upcoming, we have our spring meet with our Woodlands Advisory Committee. It's actually called the Western Region Stakeholder Interaction Committee, is the new name for it. That's made up of a bunch of members. Some of them are in the room here today, from the Mersey Tobiatic Research Institute, Paddlers of Nova Scotia, ATVANS. We have a couple local contractors. The Medway Community Forest sits on it, the municipality of Annapolis, the Nova Scotia Native Council, which would be the Off Reserve First Nations of Nova Scotia, as well as there's a member of the Queens County Fish and Game and the Registered Professional Forester. So we have a group of about 20 people that sit and do this, go through the same process as the First Nations do, as they review all our harvest blocks. And we get together 3 times a year. It's right today because the license hasn't, we haven't signed our long-term agreement. DNR manages that process today. So the mayor's on our committee, and DNR would run that committee today, that advisory committee. And on top of that, sort of the final stage of all of that is if you go on the DNR website, you can actually look at all our proposed harvests. You can put comments in. You can request the on-the-ground information as to what led for what treatment, whether it's a soil type, the veg type, the species composition of the trees, all the different characteristics that would go in to do an assessment on the ground. And last year, we commented on over 400, responded over 400 comments that were made on our harvest blocks. And there's a quick link there. I included it in the presentation if you want to go on there, but it's a very easy tool to use. You want to see what's actually happening in your area. And as well, if you click on a certain county, you can sign up for an automatic newsletter, so you automatically get notified if there's any new harvest. And we hope to add silviculture operations in the future, so if there's any planting or PCT work that may go on in your area, you can go on there and look. And you have up to 20 business days to make a comment once it's posted. And then after that, it remains up until the block's harvested. So you can go on and see any blocks that haven't been operated on in the past. So we still get PTA requests and comments on old blocks, some of them that have been on for over a year. They remain up there until the blocks harvested. So we do have lots of opportunities. Forest diversity, you probably hear a lot of things about the Acadian Forest in Western Nova Scotia, and that's true. We have a forest that's made up of a lot of different species, a lot of different soil types, vegetation types that spread across the landscape. That I think is a major opportunity when you compare it to maybe different parts of Canada, like the boreal forest, where they're limited to one or two tree species. One other big thing that I realize, I worked in a log camp for a year and a half, and here it's the forest is where the people are. Most of our people get to go home every night, which is not the same as the rest of Canada. If we look at from Ontario and either northern Quebec west, the people aren't where the forest is. And if you go to work in the forest, you got to stay a long way away from your family. And I think that's a big thing we have here in Nova Scotia. There's available long-term fiber to attract business. Currently today, even on Crown land, only 46% of the volume is actually allocated to a mill. So you look at that, you're looking at another 400,000 tons of wood is out there growing on the land base today that isn't being used. All right, and there's room to grow more trees. I showed it to you earlier, but how much we're harvesting is actually less than 1 cubic meter per hectare per year, and is only a third of what's being harvested on private land in the province. We have the opportunity to build partnerships, like the one I work in today, which is made up of 13 different mills that all need to rely on that land base to supply their fiber. And I got highlighted in the last bottom of that slide there, low-grade fiber and residuals. Today, with the closure of the paper mill, and then the reduction in capacity that went along with the Brooklyn Energy Plant, there's a there's a drastic oversupply of low-grade fiber on the market that we need a home for in order to do proper forest management on the land base, both from a private landowner perspective and from the Crown. And then challenges. One of our bigger challenges in terms, I said earlier, it was good that we're located close to world markets, but in Nova Scotia, if you take where the wood goes, you know, some of the shareholders, their mills are located in New Glasgow, and we're cutting wood in Yarmouth. Right, so that's a big challenge, is how do you bridge that gap from business to market. The public, it's educating and understanding and listening to the concerns of the public members of cutting trees versus forest management. All right, the next one is old natural forest. So we have a lot of that part of the land base, two-thirds of it never had management occurring at on a regular basis. So we have a lot of old, low-grade, high pulp content stands because it was, you know, parts of old Crown that were never managed by the Bowater Mersey Paper Company and thus weren't needed for fiber allocation. And then we talked a little about it earlier, the marketplace. There's a perception out there that the Crown land is being harvested and taking the place of private wood in the market, and it's just not the case today. And most of the way the agreement's set up, it will not be the case in the future. And then the last one, contractor capacity. We're doing a lot of different harvesting prescriptions on the land base, and today our harvesting capacity hasn't caught up to that type of equipment we need. Today, only 50% of our harvesting capacity is the equipment we actually need to do the treatments we're able to do on Crown land. And that's a gap. Slowly but surely, we're getting that change, but it's a challenge today is to match types of equipment we have with the work we're going to do on the land base. And so then you look at the potential. If we were to harvest the full AHC last year, we would have put an additional $7.5 million in the provincial fund in terms of stumpage revenue. We only harvested about 40% of the wood, and we paid over $4 million in stumpage to the Crown. And if the AHC was fully utilized on top of that, if you look at the fact that we make up 22% of our mill supply, and there was an additional 400,000 tons in the market, if you combine that with the private, it'd be for a total of 1.8 million tons to potentially be available to for somebody to use in Western Nova Scotia. And in relation to that, it's another pulp mill the size of Northern Pulp and a sawmill just slightly smaller than the Freeman Lumber. All right, put it in perspective, that's how much wood's growing in Western Nova Scotia that it isn't being utilized today, if you look at it compared to the provincial context. That's the potential of Crown land in Western Nova Scotia. And that's with 40% of it set aside for parks and protected area. So that was the end of my show, as you can probably see from your paper slides. Are there any questions?
Before I take questions, I would like to clarify one point, if I may.
Okay.
I am a member of the Department of Natural Resources Western Region Stakeholder Interaction Committee, which provides advice on Crown lands, including the activities that West Forum may provide on those lands in the forestry sector. The advisory committee extends beyond forestry on the Crown lands, and I do that capacity as a volunteer of the Queens County Fish and Game Association, one of my volunteer hats. Peter Jones, a local resident, is chair of that committee, and certainly associations are welcome to apply to be on that advisory committee at the will of the committee. So I wanted to add that, if I may.
There's two open spots right now.
Yes, there are vacancies. So anyone who's interested in an association that would have input, we'd love to hear from you, I'm sure, through Peter Jones. Any questions or comments of councillors? Deputy Mayor McLeod.
Very good presentation. Very helpful. And when you talk about Nova Scotia and you talk about the economics or you talk about just where Nova Scotia sits in that capacity, we talk forestry first, then we talk fisheries, and then we talk tourism. And it's really good to know what potential there is out there in the forestry industry, and how can we attract people to take advantage of that, and still be able to keep the sustainability and the environmentally concerns that we have, you know, and employment. I mean, that's the biggest thing we want to attract here is employment. If this is available to us, how can we get an interest in that as an industry?
As an industry, well, it's funny you say that. I'm part of a group right now. We're trying to attract consumers, some of those low-grade fiber on the land base. It's made of, there's three of us that are part of the committee today, with the other two are members of, they had the local woodlot services groups for Western Nova Scotia, so they would represent large, over each one of them represents one over 3,000 woodlot owners, and the other one a significant volume, but we've actually gone to the government, we've made presentations, we have a project proposal in place to try and attract someone here, be either through, mostly for that low-grade fiber be used for energy, okay, whether it be central heating or something along that nature. But there are, right today, I don't have the answer as to what we should do, but there is the opportunity out there, and the more and more I get to talk to people, the more and more each day, all of a sudden they say, geez, I we didn't realize there was actually that much wood growing or that much fiber growing on the land base in Western Nova Scotia. So there are lots of opportunities right from Yarmouth all the way through to Halifax of opportunities to use that fiber in the land base.
And you know, there are a lot of properties in the rural areas that have a lot of woodland, and they're just sitting there. And you know, and people want to divest of that. They're getting older, they want to divest of that. But they really don't know what to do, and they're kind of confused as to, what do I do with all this? And then that's more land that isn't even part of this, volume. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yes. And that's a big part of what people, like, there are a lot of new ventures, and there's two mainly in Western Nova Scotia, would say a lot, but there are two. They're trying to, attract those people to enter the marketplace. You've probably heard of Will Martin's group, as well as there's a new Western Region Woodlot Services group as well. That's another group venture that started with represented by a group of woodlot owners that are trying to do exactly what you're talking about, is unlock or actually inform people and show them what they can do with their lands.
Mm-hmm. Councilor Muse?
You said the tree planting.
Yes.
Years ago, like Bowwaters had at the greenhouse to do. Is that coming back? Do a little more tree planting?
Right today, we probably won't be doing more tree planting than Bowwater did. And there's the reason for that is on Crown land, we don't do herbicide. Okay? I don't know if you guys are aware of that or not, but the Bowwater did. And one of the things to make plantations successful is to manage that vegetation for the first 5 to 6 years of its life. And if you don't have a means to manage that vegetation, plantations don't survive. And that's why the dramatic shift into the partial harvesting that you're seeing, some of those methods, and all that's to promote natural regeneration, although it is slower and it does fade and it's more costly to do. But at the end of the day, if we put herbicide out of the toolbox, to put trees in the ground and plant them and manage that vegetation so they don't die, there's just no economical means of doing it. So when you see more trees being planted, no. What you'll see is what I showed you pictures of, that type of treatment to try and encourage natural regeneration. And that's the direction we've been given on Crown land. So, and to sort of say that, on top of that, all our trees now come out of, because it's Crown land, you have to purchase them from the provincial nursery in Cape Breton. So the trees that we'll be responsible to plant in Western Nova Scotia, that's where they're going to come from the provincial tree nursery in Inverness.
So there is no more, like, the youth to even plant hardwood? They don't?
Nope, we do all that all through natural regeneration today.
Councilor Fancy?
Yeah. I like your presentation, and I like to even see how the setup is and everything else. There's a couple of concerns that I have, and just from the people I know and working at the mill and everything else. You talked about the clear cut in particular. We talk all we want, but I just drive up to Caledonia and I see open areas and open areas.
Yeah.
And you were saying about clear cut, if it's anything over 50%, it's called clear cut.
That's
right?
Correct.
Why do we... why set a standard in that way, that like you showed about the pine grove, pine tree harvest and the shelterwood harvest, that maybe you have to allow 20% to stay, whatever it may be, to make it look, it looks ugly. I mean, how it works away with grounds and how the grounds wash away, how it erodes the soils and all these other things. So I don't know why we need to, we're not into a spot of going to that deep, so why do we do that?
Why do we clear cut? The primary reason we clear cut, there's two reasons. One is we don't have enough regeneration on the site. Okay, so we go in and look at the site, all right, and there's not enough regen there for a whole host of different reasons. And the easiest way to promote regen on a site is to allow sunlight to come down to take the seed source that's in the soil, all right, and expose it to sunlight, water, and nutrients, and allow those trees to come up. That's the primary, when the guys are doing the PTA assessments on the ground, that's the first criteria that determines whether or not we do a clear cut. And the second thing is we have to evaluate how much, or for how many long-lived species there are on the site. And the reason we do that is because they're typically deep-rooted and they won't blow down. Okay, so the primary species we leave behind in most of those harvests are red spruce, hemlock, white pine, sugar maple. If we don't have at least 40% of those species on site, then what happens is we tend to get more blowdown than what the Crown would consider acceptable on a site, and most private woodlot owners as well. So if we leave those species at 40% or less on site, unless it's a white pine seed tree, typically we do white pine hemlock seed trees, they are deep-rooted enough, they will stand. At, like you see in that seed tree harvest, they will stand. But red spruce, sugar maple, those species, if you leave them all by themselves in those areas to try and get that regen established, in most cases they blow over, or they blow over at a rate that's not considered acceptable. Okay, that's the reason why we do clear cuts. And most of the ones you do see, I won't lie, a lot of circumstances were cleaning up a mess, I call it. The stands in certain areas were hydrated, they were gone in 50 years ago, and the best pine and the best spruce were taken out, and the rest was left. And it never amounted to much in terms of a forest that we wanted. And the only way to reset that is to take those balsam fir, the white birch, the red maple off the site, and try and get that seed source growing back again, and manage it to what you've seen on the pictures. Most of those sites will go back every 10 years and take a portion of the volume out. All right, and hopefully we go from a 40% pulpwood forest to a 5% pulpwood forest. That's the goal. You know, some of those stands you see, we got 95% solubles off, actual saw material, which is amazing compared to the rest of the province.
But continuing on that same question, I got two questions, but continuing on that same question, is that years ago we always had to leave a buffer out by the road, and I didn't see those blow down. I hear what you're saying, but there was always a buffer there, so it looked good anyway. And I didn't see those blow down, so what's the difference now?
So, well, the buffers typically, like that you would have seen along, like in our management plan on any paved primary road, so
yes.
Route 8, Route 10, highway, we leave 50-meter buffers. We're not allowed to operate in them, so for that very reason, they don't blow down. So you don't open up any canopy space for the wind to get in and blow them over. So we can't operate, when you leave those buffers, the primary goal is do not operate in them, so you don't remove any trees, so that you don't open the canopy enough up to allow blow down to come through. But once you open the canopies up on a lot of those sites, if we were to remove 30 or 40% of the volume in there, you wouldn't see that blow down happen. So if you disperse that across the entire area, that's what would end up happening. Today, on Crown land, we're willing to accept up to 30% blow down and still do a partial harvest.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So that's the tolerance level. So if we go in and we assess it, and they say, okay, we know that the soil isn't great, it's very high rock, different things, but it's got the long-lived species that we need on site, we're willing to go in there, do a partial harvest, and still accept 30% blow down.
Yep.
And consider that still successful. That's the threshold of whether or not we, even though the soil type or the amount of rockiness or different things there aren't indicative of a clear cut, or aren't indicative of a partial harvest, but we still do it, knowing that we're willing to risk up to 30% of the trees blowing down on that site. That's the threshold.
That's the second question, if you don't mind. The other thing too, you talked about the mill and Brooklyn Power being down, which has cut back on a lot of the,
yes,
the usage. But again, we also too have like places like Muscadavis.
Yes.
We used to take a lot of wood there for their pellet plant, and other sawmills shutting down. What was it? Heffler? Wasn't it?
Well, Heffler's not. It's not shut down. Today it's,
yeah,
going through a transition. They're not sawing lumber as of December 15th,
okay,
of last year. All right, and it's going through a transition in ownership, and they haven't decided whether they're going to start the sawmill up yet or not.
Right.
They're still running their bioenergy plant, and they're buying 100% private, low-grade wood,
right,
to feed it today.
And I know I have family and I have other friends who work in the woods, and they said that there's a lot of wood that's 2 years old and more just laying in the woods that's not being hauled out. There's no place for it.
That's correct.
It's been overcut. Speculation? Is this what, I don't know what's happened anyway.
I'm not sure what you mean.
I don't know. They said it's laying in the woods, and they aren't hauling it out because they have no place to go with it. So I don't know. Was that something just to over?
Well, that would be what I talked about earlier about the low grade market for low grade products,
right,
today. Stems below 4 inches, they're,
yes,
in Western Nova Scotia, there is no home for it.
Okay.
There is no market for low grade fiber. And if you look across Nova Scotia with the contraction of the PHP plant, you guys probably heard about that. The biomass plant in Port Oxford Paper that generate electricity.
Yeah.
Between that, the operation in Muscadavis,
mm-hmm,
right, between those two events alone, that last year that represents 600,000 tons of fiber,
mm-hmm,
for low grade, those trees you're talking about, the crooked pine tops and the
right.
the very last piece on the end of the spruce tree, or the poplar, some of the other species that have no saw material in it, that's where they went. And today those markets don't exist in 2017 in Nova Scotia. And it makes forest management very, very difficult and costly.
Okay.
All right, because those products make up a significant volume on our landscape, probably 30% of the average woodlot in Nova Scotia. And today there is not a home for them.
Okay.
All right, they don't represent up a lot of revenue. Like less than 5% of the revenue per acre you would generate off a forest operation,
yeah.
but they represent a significant volume. And right today you're correct that in a lot of circumstances there is no home for that last piece of spruce or fir or that crooked pine top or things that there might have been a home for 15, 20 years ago. Today there isn't. And a lot of it's due to the production of those two facilities.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other councillor? Councillor Kelly?
I appreciate the information. It's our forest land is something that I'm just always trying to get my head around who owns what and how it works. But when you talk about markets for product from our crown land, are we only talking about markets within Nova Scotia? Is that all you deal with? Or are there export markets out there that we're researching?
There are export markets outside of Nova Scotia where our private wood goes today. All right, for a reason that the private has the first chance in the marketplace. So we do export roundwood fiber from Nova Scotia, not off crown land. Okay, so today to export fiber off crown land outside Nova Scotia, we'd have to get special permission from the crown to do that.
And why would that be?
They want the economic benefit of consuming that fiber to be held in house.
But we have, but were you just saying we have access?
We have access today, yes. But today we're not exploring opportunities to export that forest fiber to other jurisdictions.
And you don't know why. If we have access, but we're not looking for where those access markets can be outside Nova Scotia, because we're obviously not identified in Nova Scotia.
But the opportunity would be more to grow those markets in Nova Scotia to use that fiber, not to export it, in order to get the jobs and the economic activity that go with it.
Okay, then. So how does this all fit together? You manage, West Ford took over Resolute lands as that became Crown lands, and then you took them over? Is that how that worked?
Part of it.
Right.
Okay, so we manage about a third of the area we manage was former Resolute lands.
Right.
So there was a whole bunch of buckets that the former Resolute lands were divided up into, per se. 40% of them went in Parks and Protected.
Okay.
All right, that was bucket number one.
Okay.
And that was as of January 1st, 2016. A portion of them went to two First Nations forest initiatives, and then a portion of them went to the Medway Community Forest Co-op,
okay.
and then a portion of them we manage today.
Okay.
So they were divided up amongst different different land managing buckets.
Okay, but and you're just Western Nova Scotia.
That's
is
correct.
Another
yes.
company like yours that does.
So the rest of the province works a little bit different. All right, so PHP or Oxford Paper in the southern eastern counties has a FULA or a long term. With when the mill was bought by the new owners in 2012 or 2013, that mill was purchased by new owners, the Stern Group,
yeah.
and they have the same agreement that we hoped we would get, except for the seven eastern counties. Then in the central part of the province, there's actually a couple different short-term license agreements with a couple different mills. So there's no, in the central part of the seven central counties, there's no individual FULA holder or land manager like there is in the west. So there's three for sure, three different sort of the timber license agreements that we used to have in Western Nova Scotia.
How much, compared to how much private land is there? There's crown land, is private land in Queens County. What's the percentage of private forest?
So this isn't land. When I talk quote numbers here, I'm talking forested land only. But
right.
So if you look at it in Queens County, 56% of the forested area is crown. 3% is industrial freehold, so that would be lands of a certain size that are owned by companies, like J.D. Urban Limited or the Pulp or whoever. And then 41% it would be considered small private, okay, or private land.
Councillor Kelly, I'm going to move on to Councillor Johnson.
My question was answered.
Okay.
Marketing runs it or somewhere else.
Any other councillor that has a question or comment? Councillor Kelly, did you have an additional question?
No.
Thank you, Marcus. Very interesting presentation.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Appreciate that. And I would like to recognize Richard and Charlie Freeman in the public gallery today, who represent Freeman Lumber, a stakeholder in West Ford. Appreciate you coming today as well.
Thank I like the sign at the back, I already put the picture, I'll be using that in another presentation.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Mark.
Yes, thank you.
I would now move on to 3.2, Queens Community Health Board, Cannabis Legislation, Municipal Policy Secretary Louise Popper, if you'd like to come forward.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor, councilors.
Good morning.
Staff and members of the public. Thank you for this opportunity to be here today. As you are likely aware, the federal government is moving forward with their campaign promise to legalize cannabis to protect the health of the population, especially children and youth. The Queens Community Health Board is invested in the health of our community, and so we are eager to ensure that the cannabis legalization is implemented in such a way that the protection of health is the goal. And I'd like to introduce myself. I'm the chair of the Queens Community Health Board, and Louise Hopper is the coordinator for the Queens Health Board. Who we are? So this is the members of our committee, and it represents a broad range of people from across the county. What is our role in the community? As volunteers of the Nova Scotia Health Authority, we have a legislative responsibility to support health promotion in the community. This includes being a catalyst for change, initiating conversations about issues that are important to our community, facilitating connections between groups, promoting health programs and services, advocating for programs and policy change that are based on evidence, distributing wellness grants to community groups, seeking accurate information and communicating this to the public and the Nova Scotia Health Authority. Most importantly, the conversation about cannabis legalization is our role in advocating for policies that protect the health of our community. So the background around this, today we are here to share what we know so far about cannabis and the legalization and the possible implications for council. The Liberal government made a campaign promise to legalize cannabis in order to protect public health. To move this forward, a federal task force was created to advise on legalization and regulation. The task force finished its work in November 30th and made its final report available on December the 13th, 2016. In a few minutes, we will highlight some of the task force recommendations. The government will consider this advice of the task force in developing the new framework. In terms of the Queens Community Health Board, we have an important role in advocating for health policies. Cannabis legalization is controversial, as there are varying public opinions as to whether it should remain illegal except for medical purposes. Be legalized, if so, what level of regulation, or be completely illegal, including, to be completely legal, including the medical use. So, to become more informed on this issue, the Queen's Community Health Board invited Todd Leader, and Todd is a former Director of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and a presentation from the Injury-Free Nova Scotia to present the current evidence around cannabis use and legalization at a public information session that we held in our community in December 2016. And that was open to stakeholders of our community and the general public were invited to an evening session that was an information session. So what we know about cannabis use. With legalizations, researchers will be able to start collecting more robust data. Until then, we do have some basic information about cannabis use. Most commonly used illicit substance in Canada, the highest proportion of use are among our youth aged 15 to 25. Nova Scotia has the highest lifetime usage rates and second highest youth rates, and these are 2013 data. It carries some significant health risk, especially if used at an early age. Psychosis, increased risk of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, impaired driving, child poisonings, so there certainly are significant risks. Most people who use cannabis do not use other illegal drugs. 57,314 police reported drug offenses related to the possession of cannabis in 2014 in Canada. 40,000 people currently hold medical marijuana license, 35 licensed dealers in Canada. So the public health approach to minimize harm. A public health approach treats cannabis as a health issue, not a criminal or economic issue. Such an approach is based on evidence, addressing the underlying determinants of health, and putting health promotion and the prevention of death, disease, injury, and disability as a central mission. To this end, the Task Force and Injury-Free Nova Scotia have proposed the following regulations. So I'm going to highlight some of these. Set the minimal age of purchase, provincial harmonization. Many health professionals and organizations have recommended 25 years of age for the legal age of use of cannabis, which is a bit unrealistic when we think about legalizing such a substance in our community, and many of the youth will still continue to use it, and then we would have a high incidence of criminalization of cannabis. However, the task force is recommending the legal age be harmonized with the legal drinking age. No advertising, marketing, promotion. So this means no sponsorship or branding. Most marketing is targeted towards children. So we want to ensure protection and reduce the likelihood of or delay onset of use. There should be no advertising or promotion of the cannabis products. Plain packaging and restriction of labeling. Similar to advertising, packaging needs to be plain so it does not entice children, and labeling needs to be clearly identified of what it is and the product. Strict regulations for edible products. In cases of cannabis poisoning, it has been children eating edible cannabis products. There needs to be strict regulations regarding what types of edible products can be produced, the THC content, packaging, and etc. They should not be appealing to children. None of that bubblegum flavored cannabis product. The federal government, to maintain full regulatory authority, In order to create consistency between provinces, cannabis legislation should be regulated at the federal level. The government only distributors at standalone outlets, so cannabis products should not be sold in outlets where alcohol or tobacco are sold. I know there's been some media coverage lately about that, and people saying they should be in the Nova Scotia Liquor Commissions, but that needs to be closely looked at. Co-locating them increases the risk of impulse buying and exposure to products one is not intending to buy. So if you're going into the liquor store and think, oh, well, maybe I'll try that, or, you know, it just creates more the likelihood of buying. Priced and taxed by strength. Higher prices based on the strength means more people are likely to buy products with lower THC content, which decreases the harm. A safe and responsible supply chain. Moving people to purchasing from a legal regulated system versus illegal criminal distribution. Outlet density and hours of operation. Where outlets are located and the hours of operation are impact for the usage. So, implications for council. Why we think this is important for us to come here today to speak to council. A coordinated and proactive implementation plan, across all orders of government will be essential to rolling out a legalized marijuana framework. Municipalities will be on the front lines of implementing and enforcing this new regulatory regime for the production, distribution, and consumption of cannabis. So there must be clear information sharing between orders of government and clear roles and responsibilities and coordinations on enforcement, compliance with health, safety and building codes, and emergency response. So what we need to consider, public concern and opinion. Council may be faced with community opposition or support for the new legislation and will have to decide how to respond. Land use bylaws. Requests may come forward regarding land use for cannabis production and sale. Municipal policies. Other municipal policies like smoke-free places, workplace policies may be impacted. Municipal planning and zoning. Do your planning and zoning policies prevent cannabis production or sales near schools, daycares, residential neighborhoods? Rights of employers or employees. As an employer, what policies will you have regarding employees and cannabis use? Public safety and enforcement. How will the new regulations be enforced? Will additional resources be required? Economic development. Economic development is very important to municipalities, and we realize that. And the health of our community should be very important as well. However, it is important to look at cannabis from a health lens and not an economic one. So, what our ask is to council, to participate in the Union of Nova Scotia Municipalities Cannabis Legalization Symposium in May. Yes, I just heard that was, you all were invited to that, so that's wonderful. We're getting ahead of the talks, and then when we were on the agenda for here, we did realize that was coming up, so good for you. Municipal decisions regarding cannabis aligned with public health approach, integrated approach, collaboration with public health, addictions and mental health, health promotion, and injury-free Nova Scotia. Those are all people that are willing to sit down to the table and talk about this. a commitment to review and revise relevant policy recommendations from a harm reduction lens. So not only policies around the cannabis legalization, but also other policies that the council deals with regarding health in our community that would impact the health and wellness of our community. Anything I missed? All right. So thank you for this opportunity to present this information on this very important issue. And I'd now like to take questions.
Thank you, Tara. Any councillors have questions or comments?
One thing, I'm on the medical board, so I'm just not on the medical board, but on the what do you call it? Well, emergency protection. So I get the terminology right. Is that I guess the differentiate between legalizing that marijuana and the medical marijuana, which people all put together as a clump, right? And they say. And so, with the cases that have come up with the medical marijuana, it's changed the landscape. So it's made people look at it differently. Even Health Canada and such as is looking at it differently, which is again, it's something that's here. It's not going to go away. So it's how do you deal with it? And I like your presentation today,
Councillor Kelly.
I'd like to ask, just because we've not seen, until it's made legal, we don't know exactly what the implications are going to be, right, from the federal government. But one would think that, you have these policies around smoking so that they don't affect other people, because we know what smoking does to other people. Like, you want to do that to yourself, that's fine, but it's the passive side of things, right? So do you know anything about can you comment at all on, if and when it's made legal, how people can use that? Like, if on the street, I mean, we all know now you can walk down a street and you know that either it's coming out of people's homes or someone's smoking along the street or something like that. There's no mistaking the smell of marijuana smoke. And people, that bothers a lot of people. And I think a lot of people are worried about how that will affect their lives once it's made legal. And people just seem to think that people are, and maybe it's true, they'll be just smoking marijuana everywhere and our whole town will be filled with smoke once again. Just because it's legal doesn't mean that, it should be in other people's spaces, right? Do you have any comments on that? Or?
I don't think we or the provincial government knows. Certainly, that will be things that our provincial government will be looking at, because
right.
It looks like the federal legislation is really going to say, a lot of that will be left up to the provinces.
Oh, okay.
So then that's where you probably will put into place the policies around, inclusive of cannabis use, that you can't use it within 25 feet of a building, or, that's something that's going to have to be worked into policies.
Right.
It's not included now. I think.
We have, of course, no, you're aware of Nova Scotia's smoke-free bylaws,
mm-hmm.
and some municipalities go beyond what the minimum is. So there are opportunities, certainly, for the municipality to create or amend their own bylaws to be inclusive of cannabis. It sparks, and perhaps we should check previously, but the wording of the smoke-free legislation and whether or not it would be inclusive of cannabis products. And I'm not sure of the exact language, so it may include any product that would be smoked and inhaled.
Right.
And so if it does already, then automatically those laws would apply.
Oh, okay, right.
My hope and assumption is that the wording is that way, but I couldn't be certain without looking at it. But I think, again, from an advocacy point of view, if it's not written that way, I would see community health boards and other organizations across the province advocating that those policies be reviewed and revised to include cannabis.
Right.
Absolutely. Because that is old smoke, secondhand
mm-hmm.
smoke.
Yes.
And,
Deputy Mayor McLeod.
On that same topic, and the federal government hasn't come up with regulations yet. They've just, okay, we're going to legalize this. Now we'll do the behind, you know, we'll do all of that work to control the use of it and the public use of it and whatever else, medical use of it. And I'm assuming that probably because it's termed as a drug, it may be treated as alcohol such that you can't use it in public spaces at all. You know,
yeah.
And it's hard to hide, I know, but it's quite obvious if you don't know if somebody, you know, you see somebody smoking a joint, I'll just use, you know, you see somebody smoking one, and then you know, obviously, that it's a drug, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, when you're next to somebody, you see it in public, you really know that it's going to be, if they say it's illegal, you know that that's an offense.
Yeah, absolutely. I know one of the things that is really being pushed is that cannabis legislation near tobacco legislation more closely than alcohol legislation,
mm-hmm.
because we've done a much better job around the branding, so you're not allowed to advertise tobacco products. You can't have Des Mauriers sponsoring youth soccer events, those types of things, whereas you can still see the Keats Festival in Halifax and that type of branding, you know, beer, Labatt's, Zamboni's at the rink,
yeah.
those types of things. So we're not at the same place with alcohol legislation. So the advocates are really pushing for it to be more closely aligned with tobacco. But certainly, again, with our Smoke-Free Places Act, where you can use it, but certainly have to follow. And there's some issues with enforcement, and you know, you still see people smoking outside the doors of public places that they shouldn't be, but certainly, hopefully, and that's sort of the role of Community Health Boards and maybe municipalities to advocate for those types of bylaws, policies, regulations to be put in place to protect people from the get-go.
But it's hard to do that until the federal government comes out with their list first.
Yeah, absolutely.
Councillor Johnson.
Just a quick question. I should know this answer, but I don't. When is the last date for input from the general public and consultation? When are they going to stop hearing the comments from the general public and from the Union of Nova Scotia Municipalities and actually draw the line in the sand and say it's legal and these are the rules?
I think any form of formal consultation is over because the Federal Task Force has put in their recommendations. Just yesterday in the news, it was noted that April 20th, they're gonna introduce legislation, but that it's not likely to be till July of next year that it will actually become a legalized product that you can not be charged with possession and those types of things. So I think the intent is to give provinces that year to create those legislations and regulations, because I think you will see the federal government kind of download a lot of that to the individual provinces, which isn't what's being recommended by a number of advocates, but I think that's what will end up happening. So I think the message is that consultation per se is done, advocacy doesn't stop. So if there's something that we see that's important, that we continue to push for that.
Councillor Kelly?
So is there anything that you could provide us with now to tell us, like, how would we, once it comes out then, how would we go about advocating to our, I guess, to the province to affect however they're going to come out with legislation or laws around the federal legislation on legalization? Yeah, I think working with those stakeholders that are already kind of well positioned and really pushing. So Interfe Nova Scotia, I know the Nova Scotia Health Authority will certainly be pushing for the public health approach. You know, maybe as a municipal council, you take a position that we are going to look at it from with a health lens, with a public health lens, and to protect, you know, looking to protect the population of our communities. And when there's opportunities at the Union of Nova Scotia Municipalities,
municipalities if there are opportunities to work collaboratively with colleagues across the province. You know, I think there's opportunities for us all as individuals, but also as collectives to kind of continue to push our provincial government to make sure that they're seeing it from a health lens, because it's very clear that once governments take an economic or profit-driven lens, that we quickly see the health of the public is kind of, it's secondary. So often that's when you see the greatest harms, because they're driven by selling the most edible products, driven by selling the most product to drive revenue and versus protecting the population. So
what about our residents of our district, if they ask us what to do, what would it be like writing to the MLAs to take that information to the provincial government, or even writing to yourselves so that you could take their information through the Nova Scotia Health Authority to the provincial government?
Certainly that's what's being promoted. I don't know if I have any of the cards here with me, but MLAs and MPs, absolutely, that's where we're being told. So the Community Health Board certainly will be approaching them next.
Okay.
We certainly wanted to start with local government first, because this is going to impact the people in our community. But yes, absolutely, all levels of government, and they should ask them to write letters.
Okay.
They can certainly direct us, and we can support them as well.
Okay.
It should be noted that the Union of Nova Scotia Municipalities will likely continue to take presentations and information through this process, as well as the opportunity that we have with our MP, Bernadette Jordan, who will be one of the members voting on the bill.
Yes.
So there's an opportunity as we move forward. Any other councillors? Questions or comments this morning? I would like to thank you, Tara and Louise. A very interesting presentation.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for coming. Move on to 4.0, opening of petitions. Are there any petitions to be tabled today? Any petitions coming forward? Hearing none, we will move on to 5.0, public question and comment session. I would ask those that would like to speak to please give their name, address, and limit their comments to 5 minutes, please. Mr. Robinson.
Full 5 minutes for this one. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Leon Robertson. First of all, I just want to make the comment that I heard on the radio this morning on the news that high-speed internet is going to be coming to Greenfield and Caledonia areas that are looking for high-speed in America. And I understand that the timeline there is in August, I believe, to have that up and running in those areas. They also mentioned Jordan Falls and a couple of other areas as well. So it's nice to hear that, because I know those people will be able to really like to be able to get on the net on a regular basis. Couple other comments. Listening to the presentation here this morning that was just finished on cannabis, it looks as though that there's a ways to go yet to find out how everything is going to fall and come together, but it looks as though that the municipalities, municipal units, may be involved there, or will be involved there with respect to maybe changing policies or adding policies, bylaws, and so on, and also it was even mentioning about the possibility of enforcement. And if that's the case, you may have some work on your hands. It depends on how the legislation, I guess, ends up being, and where it goes from there. And lastly, there's an item coming up under number 13.1, the purchase and sale agreement for the Millbrae School. And if that is approved, will that be available for a copy for the public?
Under 13.1 today, when we deal with the issue, copies of all relative documents will be available for circulation.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
I guess you're alone today, Leon.
Yes, that's it.
Thank you.
Crushed up through the ice.
Yes, Leon, are you able to hear well today?
It's much better, yeah.
Pleased to hear that, thank you. We will move on now to 6.1, approval of minutes of the last regular council, March the 14th. I would entertain a motion to accept the minutes. Councillor Fisk, seconder. Councillor Muse, are you ready for the question? All those in favor? It is unanimous, thank you. Under 7.0, dangerous or unsightly premises, we have nothing to come forward today that I'm aware of.